Welcome to Simple Living Works, episode 101. I'm Jerry Iverson. It's my pleasure to be your host with my guest, Paul K. Chappell, Peace Leadership Director of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation. If you're new to this podcast and would like more basic information about Simple Living Works, please listen clear to the end. If you're a regular, you may want to say goodbye at my cue. I had the pleasure of organizing an event recently for the Paso Peace Community. Our guest speaker was Paul K. Chappell. Over 80 peace seekers heard Paul's inspiring presentation, Why World Peace is Possible. Paul K. Chappell is the Peace Leadership Director of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation, an Iraq War veteran, West Point graduate, international speaker, and author of 6 books. Nobel Peace Prize laureate Archbishop Desmond Tutu has said of him, Paul K. Chappell has given us a crucial look at war and peace from the unique perspective of a soldier, and his new ideas show us why world peace is both necessary and possible in the 21st century. The end of war can help people everywhere understand why war must end and how together we can end it. Our event was co-sponsored by the Paso Peace Community, members of the North County Clergy Group, Rotary International Peace Builders, and the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation. See the show notes for links to Paul's sites and the new Peace Literacy site. Here's Paul, recently recorded. Paul, you have a really touching personal story about how you moved from rage to peace. And so please tell us your personal story about how you moved from being a young, an angry child to being a peace activist.
Yeah, a lot of things happened along the way, but critical realization was understanding that I had to develop some skills in order to heal my own rage, heal my own trauma, and interact with people more peacefully, and realizing that I was not taught how to do that in the educational system. And many parents don't know how to teach their children how to do that in our society. And so I had to figure out how to learn a lot of that on my own. And it took quite a while to do that.
When did you decide you wanted to be a writer?
Yeah, so when I was 15, I had to write a short story for an English class when I was a sophomore in high school. And my English teacher told me that I should be a writer. She told me she liked my story and I should be a writer. And I had never thought about being a writer before because I didn't like to read books back then. So I wrote another story and another. And I realized that I had liked writing that story. And the more I wrote, the more I developed an obsession with it. And I think that single comment really changed my life in terms of just that kind comment, I think, really pushed me down a different path. And I don't think I'd be alive today if my teacher had not said that to me. I grew up in Alabama. And my mother's Korean. My father's half white, half black. He was born in 1925 in Virginia. He had me in 1954. He was in the Army for 30 years, fought in the Korean and Vietnam Wars. Yeah, I graduated from West Point. I was in the Army for 7 years. I was deployed to Iraq, left the Army in 2009 as a captain.
And what did you discover while you were in the military about how it operates?
Yeah, just changed my view a lot on why in the 21st century war is not an effective way to provide national and global security, and how it can actually increase the risk to national and global security.
So after you left the military, then you joined the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation.
Yes.
And you've been working with them ever since, and doing what?
I'm the Peace Leadership Director, teaching peace leadership, and I give lectures, workshops, develop curriculum with educators, write books, a lot of research and content development.
Having heard you speak, and I appreciate just how articulate you are, I understand that you use a lot of psychology and a lot of philosophy in your speaking and your writing. And I understand that that also is a basis for your point of view. So I'd like you to give us a summary in a few minutes of how you incorporate psychology and philosophy into teaching, or how to getting people's attention for the need for peace literacy.
Yeah, I really focus on, I focus the discussion first on what is the human condition and how our understanding of peace has to derive from a realistic understanding of the human condition. I tie in psychology and philosophy, but a lot of what I talk about, psychology doesn't address. And so I think that we have to have a clear view of what it means to be human, and only then can we really have a realistic understanding of what realistic peace would look like. And I think a lot of the naive views toward peace are because people don't have a realistic understanding of the human condition, which can, and those naive views can cause people to believe this myth that humans are naturally violent, and this naive view can also cause people to underestimate humans' capacity for violence. So I'm not saying that people can't become violent, but if somebody gets HIV or heart disease or diabetes or malaria, nobody ever says that's human nature. People realize that illnesses have a preventable cause. And people say, well, how do we fix this? And in a similar way, violence is caused by these preventable causes, these underlying causes that, that we can prevent, such as trauma and other things. And so seeing violence as having preventable causes like illness, and how do we deal with the root causes of violence? And these root causes can make people extremely, extremely dangerous. But I think having a clear understanding of what those root causes are is just a fraction of understanding what the human condition is.
Well, give us some examples of those underlying conditions.
So trauma is one, and I write about that from the perspective of somebody who has had a lot of rage issues. And also just understanding the human condition in terms of what causes our modern problems. And how does that result from different aspects of our humanity?
When you say trauma, we think about getting hit on the head, but you're thinking about trauma more broadly than that, I think.
Physical head trauma can increase violent behavior, or physical head trauma can increase the risk of violent behavior. There are many serial killers who have had physical head trauma as children, and that's one risk factor. And psychological trauma is also another risk factor in increased violent behavior. And psychological trauma, especially childhood trauma, things like neglect, physical abuse, psychological abuse, sexual abuse, they can be risk factors for an increased likelihood of violent behavior.
The mission of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation is to educate and advocate for peace and a world free of nuclear weapons, and to empower peace leaders. And so that's what you do. You're the educator, education director, and you do that through speaking and writing. I know that you have, for example, some videos on YouTube that where people can hear you speak. Can you give some other examples of how the foundation itself reaches its mission? For example, the leader, Mr. Krieger, is he also involved in that?
Yeah, they write and speak about nuclear weapons abolition and the importance of that, and how the United States should take a leadership role in the abolishing of nuclear weapons, and why that's so critical in the 21st century.
This seems really, really pertinent right now with all the saber rattling going on between the U.S. administration and North Korea, and with the nuclear bomb clock being at 1 minute to midnight. This seems really very pertinent. I understand that you are about ready to issue a new peace literacy curriculum. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, we just launched a new website, peaceliteracy.org, and we have this free peace literacy curriculum on peaceliteracy.org. And the whole view is understanding peace as a practical skill set that we can use in daily life and that we can use for solving much broader problems.
Well, Paul, can you give us a sneak preview of that curriculum? Can you summarize a little bit more of it for us? Maybe give us some of the steps?
Yeah, so the first several skills are about aggression, posturing, and tie in very well with what's going on now internationally between the U.S. and North Korea, and something people can also observe in daily habits among many people. And so starting with aggression and posturing, it's something that everybody can relate to and really is something that affects problems on a personal level, national level, international level, and something that is relevant to all people's lives, especially today.
So expand on that a little more as far as how we can deal with our own aggression, how we can deal with our own posturing, but also how we can deal with aggression and posturing we see in others.
Yeah, so I asked this question, which is, if they have a pack of wolves and a grizzly bear, and there's a dead deer, and the wolves are hungry, and the grizzly bear is hungry, they will both want to eat the dead deer, what almost always happens. And I've asked this question probably hundreds of times, and most adults don't know the answer. And most adults say that the animals share or they fight. Typically, the adults will say the animals fight. And the animals actually, in most cases, don't fight. They do something called posturing. The bear will roar, the wolves will growl. And through that posturing system, one animal will typically leave. And every animal in nature postures. When animals in nature posture, they want to appear larger and they want to sound louder. So a cobra will lift up its body, spread its hood, show its fangs. A rattlesnake will shake its tail and it'll coil up into a ball. Or a gorilla will beat his chest, and a cat will hiss and arch its back, and the hair will stand up on its back. A tarantula will lift up its front legs, show its fangs. And so this is the preferred method of self-defense that animals have in nature. Unless they're hunting, they usually try to avoid violence if they can. And I asked the audience why the animals do this. Why don't they just go ahead and fight? And the reason is because in nature there are no hospitals, there are no emergency rooms. And violence is very dangerous because even if you win a fight, you might suffer a life-threatening injury. So because there's no hospitals in the wild, as their first method of self-defense, animals typically prefer posturing unless they're hunting. Now, if you ignore the animal's warning, if a rattlesnake shakes its tail, and you ignore the warning, the rattlesnake has two options. It has the fight or flight response. But the preferred method of self-defense is posturing. And so what this shows already is that we should not use the words violence and aggression as synonyms, because most aggression in nature is actually trying to deter and prevent violence. So people very often make this mistake of saying, well, humans are naturally aggressive, but that's different from being naturally violent, because most aggression, when a rattlesnake shakes its tail at you, or a cobra lifts up its body and spreads its hood, or before a skunk sprays you, it'll stand up on its front legs and posture, unless you surprise it. It'll try to warn you first. These are all attempts to actually avoid a violent confrontation. And so most aggression in nature is actually trying to prevent and deter violence. And so I very often see people use the word aggression and violence interchangeably, but most aggression is actually trying to prevent violence. And a fraction of aggression is actually trying to inflict harm. And so when you understand how posturing works in humans, we can understand, for example, why when people are about to get into a fight, they stand up tall, they push their chest out, they yell, they might push the other person to show how strong they are. This is why the Greeks had those big helmets with the plume or a horsehair crest coming out the top. This is why soldiers in ancient battles would go into battle screaming. This is why the gun became such a popular weapon, because if you look at the longbow and the crossbow, the longbow and the crossbow had longer range, higher firing rate, and better accuracy than the early musket, but the early musket made more noise. And Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman calls this the bigger bang theory. Whatever army has louder noise has a distinct psychological advantage on the battlefield. This is the whole psychology of nuclear weapons, is posturing. And the whole idea of nuclear weapons is it's like an animal showing his teeth, basically saying, if you mess with me, I'm going to bite you. But the whole intention behind these weapons is to try to deter a violent confrontation, and that's a very dangerous way to try to deter a violent confrontation. And, for example, when you mentioned saber rattling and show of force and those kinds of things, this is that part of the human brain. But I think the critical element here is we have to make a distinction between violence and aggression, because most aggressive behavior is actually trying to prevent violence.
Thank you, Paul. That's very helpful. Let's clarify, though, even further, because the mission of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation is the elimination of nuclear weapons. So if we eliminate nuclear weapons, that will also eliminate the posturing which could prevent violence.
Yeah, so what happens with nuclear weapons is they end up causing proxy wars. And the issue with posturing with animals is animals have the option to flee. So if a rattlesnake is shaking its tail and you keep walking toward the rattlesnake, the rattlesnake has the option to leave and create physical distance by just fleeing. Now, with countries don't have the option of fleeing. They don't have the option of leaving, because with ICBMs and long-range missiles, countries are basically next-door neighbors. Even if a country is halfway across the globe, ICBMs make them next-door neighbors. And so what nuclear weapons end up being, it's like putting two lions in a cage together. It's like putting a wolf and a bear in a cage, and they can't leave. So the posturing is going to keep escalating until it leads to a proxy war. There were proxy wars between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Or this very catastrophic situation could happen where it escalates into an all-out nuclear war. And so diplomacy and those kinds of things and discussions are what are really needed, because a country can't just go to Mars, right? It's stuck on this planet, and that kind of escalating rhetoric, if there's no peaceful dialogue or diplomacy, it can really escalate into really catastrophic proxy wars or into all-out nuclear war. And another misconception about aggression is when people think that aggression is an emotion, when aggression is in fact caused by underlying emotions. And so aggression is like the heat emitted from a fire. And some of the underlying fires that can cause the heat of human aggression are fear, frustration, trauma, humiliation, betrayal, our loved ones being threatened, feeling disrespected. And so aggression is always this manifestation of deeper underlying emotions where people feel hurt, and aggression can manifest itself from feelings of hurt. And so when somebody's actually aggressive, typically they might be afraid, they might feel disrespected, they might feel insecure, they might feel humiliated, they might feel guilty, they might feel annoyed, they might be reacting to childhood trauma. They might feel helpless or confused, and we have to train our mind to see aggression as a distress response. And people who are acting out aggressively, they're in some kind of distress or pain or discomfort. People don't become aggressive when they feel really good. Typically, there's some kind of underlying painful emotion causing people's aggression, which changes how we interact with people on a daily basis when we understand and we're able to internalize that.
That's very helpful, Paul. Let's take one other element that's involved in the saber rattling, and maybe how humans differ from animals, in that humans are really into face saving. That if they flee or if they back down, then what are they going to do to save face?
Oh, yeah. A human self-worth is a very strong motivator for human behavior. And that's something I talk about and write about is how self-worth is actually a basic human need. And people will often prioritize self-worth over staying alive, where if you humiliate a man in Renaissance Europe or colonial America, he might risk his life by challenging you to a duel, where he actually prioritizes his self-worth over staying alive. Or the quote from Julius Caesar, where Julius Caesar said, "Prestige has always been of prime importance to me, even outweighing life itself," where Julius Caesar prioritized self-worth, prestige, status over staying alive. And so self-worth, feelings of shame and feelings of wanting to save face, make humans very different from other animals, because other animals do not seem to display the same levels of fear of shame. And, well, this person made me look bad, and now I got to take revenge because this person made me look bad. Or this person said something to me and humiliated me in front of all these people, and now I have to take revenge because my self-worth has been damaged. And self-worth, many people associate that actually with their very life. And so that comes into the peace techniques and peace skills. When I was in the Army, I learned in the Army, they said, praise in public, punish in private, that you never want to publicly humiliate people. So in the Army, I learned that when people do something well, you should say it in front of the whole group. When people do something bad or make a mistake, you should talk to them privately because you never want to publicly humiliate people. And so the Army even recognizes the danger of publicly humiliating people. And certainly there's leaders in the Army who don't understand that. But as a general rule, it's very dangerous when you publicly humiliate soldiers because they have weapons. And if they have the opportunity and you humiliate them and you embarrass them and they don't feel that you respect them, they might shoot you in the back if they have the opportunity to, which has happened in many wars throughout history. I just want to mention regarding the humiliation aspect that in the military I learned that if you lead by example and treat your soldiers respectfully, they're more likely to risk their lives for you. Or if they feel that you're willing to put your own well-being above their own and you treat people respectfully, they perform better in any kind of work environment. And the whole thing with humiliation and saving face is also an issue with international politics. A lot of what we see going on now between countries is national leaders and countries, they're worried about saving face. So that also applies not just to the personal level, but also to the international level as well.
Thank you, Paul. We probably should do a little commercial here for the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation. How is the organization funded, and can people give memberships or donations?
We have a website, wagingpeace.org, and we rely on donors primarily. And if people would like to donate or visit our website or get more involved, they can go to wagingpeace.org.
You're based in Santa Barbara. Is that the headquarters of the foundation, or it seems like you're kind of a dispersed organization? The people I've talked to have been from numerous places.
Office is located in Santa Barbara, California.
Anything about the future, any future plans, future books that you want to share with us, either yours personally or of the foundation?
Yeah, I have a new book out called Soldiers of Peace. It just came out. We're working on getting peace literacy into more and more schools. We realize that if humanity is going to survive and solve our national and global problems, that we have to have peace literacy in every school in the world, just as we have math in every school in the world. And so we're gradually moving in that direction.
I just love your story, Paul, about how pre-literate people didn't understand that they needed literacy.
Yeah.
That it's only when it happens that they realized, how did I live without this?
Yeah, exactly. And same with peace literacy.
You've been listening to my conversation with Paul K. Chappell, Peace Leadership Director of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation. You're welcome to share your thoughts on these subjects. Email a message to simplelivingworks@yahoo.com on our Facebook page or on the Simple Living Works blog. Those addresses are given in the show notes at our website, simplelivingworks.org. Click window number 3. Also, it really helps our visibility when you give Simple Living Works a 5-star review on iTunes. My colleague Lee Van Ham's new book has been released. Lee is the executive director of Jubilee One Earth Economics, entitled From Egos to Eden, Our Heroic Journey to Keep Earth Livable. It is volume 2 of Lee's trilogy called Eden for the 21st Century. Lee and I talked about volume 1, Blinded by Progress, and volume 2 on podcasts. The links to those episodes are given in the show notes. I urge you to subscribe to one of Simple Living Works' free publications, our blog, which includes the Weekly Digest and the Weekly Nudge. Just send the word blog to simplelivingworks@yahoo.com. I've begun a new series in the Weekly Nudge called Healthy Political Practices and Spiritual Disciplines. I hope this and my other recent short features add positively to the national conversation about social change and support the voluntary simplicity movement. Need a nudge? I've been producing today's Simpler Living Nudge for over a year and welcome you to subscribe for free. Receive it by email or Twitter. Just send me an email with the subject nudge at simplelivingworks@yahoo.com. I've received lots of interesting responses, which you can read on simplelivingworks.org. Click on recent comments in window number 5, or see the link in the show notes. I'm lining up interesting thinkers and activists for this year, including Megan Jarko, head of the Sustainability Program at the University of South Dakota. Well, time to wrap up this episode of Simple Living Works podcast. If you're new to Simple Living Works and would like more basic information, please listen a little longer. If you're a regular, you may want to say goodbye here. Peace. If you haven't subscribed yet, we hope you will now through iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Remember that you can listen to all episodes of Simple Living Works podcast. They're archived twice. Access them at simplelivingworks.org, window number 3. Click Preview, Backup, and choose the episodes you want, with or without show notes. Subscriptions to this podcast and to our weekly blogs are free, and they keep you current automatically when we post something new. Urge your friends to do the same. Remember to like us on Facebook. You can also subscribe in iTunes to my other podcast, The Common Good Podcast, which I produce and co-host with Jubilee One Earth Economics. Send us your email address to receive the free monthly Simple Living Works e-news. Thanks to the band Earth Mama and to John Pitney for the music on our show. This podcast is covered by the Creative Commons Non-Commercial Attribution Share Alike license. To learn more about Creative Commons, click on its link on our website homepage. We do not solicit nor accept donations, nor do we sell anything. All our resources and services are free of charge. We're an all-volunteer organization. We at Simple Living Works believe that simple living really does work. Voluntary simplicity, choosing to live simpler lives, is a faithful, satisfying, effective, comprehensive way of life. It's not a list of rules nor living on the cheap. It avoids fads, convenience, and deprivation. It's so much more than a hobby. We believe in abundance, that there's enough for everyone's needs, not anybody's greed. We follow the saying, live simply that others may simply live, as our closing theme song proclaims. It's a balance of personal responsibility and adequacy for just public policy. It's more than personal happiness, though that's quite important. As you may sense, we put a strong emphasis on social justice. Contemporary faith-based simple living is guided by the 5 life standards of Living More with Less, the classic by Doris Janzen Longacre. I've discussed those standards in earlier episodes. The mission of Simple Living Works is equipping people of faith to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly. We extend the mission and resources of the nonprofit organization Alternatives, which served from 1973 to 2011. The 3 parts of our mission are elaborated in text and video. Links are listed in the show notes. We produce a half-hour podcast twice a month, hopefully educational and inspiring for you, your family, and your congregation or group. Until next time, this is Jerry Iverson of Simple Living Works Podcast, wishing you well as we strive to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly. Simply so others can simply live. Learn to live simply so others can simply live.
others can live. Mm-hmm.